Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. There is a theory that we evolved from aquatic apes that fed on seafood and kelp. This is how important iodine is to our development and health. Our thyroid glands don't function without it, which means our brains need it too. In fact, our entire endocrine system seems to need iodine. Incidence of breast and other reproductive cancers are higher when there's a deficiency of iodine. Iodine is also widely used as an antibacterial, antifungal, and antiseptic agent. Targeted dosing of potassium iodide are used to protect people from thyroid cancer when there is a nuclear accident or explosion. This is because when used immediately, it will block the absorption of radioactive iodine into the thyroid gland. Now keep in mind, it doesn't take a nuclear accident that isn't the only source of nuclear contamination. Depleted uranium weapons used in modern wars and drift from nuclear power plants are exposing people to very high levels of radiation all the time, as are medical procedures. There's been an epidemic of thyroid goiter and disease in areas where iodine isn't available from food and people aren't supplementing. This is decreasing, but the numbers of people with subclinical iodine deficiency persists. So do you need a primer on how and when to take iodine? Stay tuned this hour. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. In 2005, the National Academy of Sciences announced what many already knew. There's no safe dose of ionizing radiation. The late John Goffman had been saying this for years, but the National Academy brought that knowledge right into the mainstream. Why is it, then, that both ordinary and extraordinary exposures are discussed in terms of what's safe? There is no safe. Ordinary exposures include things like flying in airplanes, getting through the security measures to get on airplanes, pervasive medical procedures such as CAT scans and dental x-rays, and the routine release of gases from nuclear power plants. Extraordinary exposures include the radioactive products of nuclear fission released from nuclear power plants, most famously Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and most recently in Japan. The media dutifully trot out experts who the journalist dutifully asks, "What about health risks?" To which the experts frequently respond by reassuring the readers, viewers, or listeners that radiation levels are safe or that the risk is confined to highly exposed people. These experts have either not heard about the position taken by the National Academy of Sciences, or they're lying. I think they're lying, even though it's well-intentioned. In fact, I think most of these experts don't even know they're lying. They somehow manage to say that radiation exposures are safe even though there is no safe dose. Any dose poses a health risk. How do they engage in this kind of self-deception? In some cases, it's simply callous. Experts who are for hire or who are deeply embedded with nuclear technology in industry, like those who said the same kind of things about tobacco, simply don't use the language the same way the rest of us do. But in most, it's professional training. Experts are trained not to cause panic or alarm. Experts know more than you and me, and so have a responsibility not to frighten us. If we get panicky, we're hard to handle. There might be social instability. We might question decisions made about what health risk we want to take, and then we might want to change the way those decisions are made against what experts know is best. There, there, children. You're perfectly safe. Go back to your finger painting or iPhone or Facebook page. Let the grown-ups take care of this. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic. My guest today is Dr. David Zava, that's Z as in zebra, A, V as in Victor A, Zava, PhD, received his doctorate in biochemistry from the University of Tennessee in 1974. As founder of Z ZRT, again, Z as in zebra, R as in Ralph, T as in Tom, ZRT Labs. He has been instrumental in developing research projects with physicians and academic groups to understand the role of steroid hormones in health and disease for the past decade. He co-authored a landmark book with Dr. John Lee, What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Breast Cancer, How Hormone Balance Can Save Your Life. And we're pleased to have you back, David Zaba.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Iodine is taken up by the thyroid, and it's an interesting element. It's incorporated into a big protein called thyroglobulin. So the thyroid has a special mechanism to take up the iodine. It has what's called a symporter, or just a transport-type mechanism that concentrates it in the thyroid. And it needs to be concentrated in order to take the iodine and sort of stuff it into this protein. And this protein has now got a lot of iodine, and it's stored in the thyroid gland. That big iodinated protein then is then broken down, and as it's broken down, it releases the thyroid hormone. So that's how the thyroid, it's a lot more complex than that, but the thyroid ultimately makes thyroid hormone. So an iodine is very unique to the thyroid, but it's also used by a lot of other tissues for many other things that I'm sure we'll get into.
Yes, we will, for sure.
The thyroid. So what happens in a nuclear incident is some of the radioisotopes that are released from a meltdown or whatever, for example, happened in Chernobyl. And iodine gets into the atmosphere, so it spews out as a gas. It's I-131. It spews out as a gas, and it basically does the same thing that iodine does as it evaporates from the ocean. And it goes over to the land, and it falls in rain on the grass, and then the cows eat the grass, and then it gets incorporated into milk, and then we could get it. And that's part of our source of iodine. It can come from sea fish or sea vegetables, or it can come from animals that live relatively close to the ocean that eat the grasses that incorporate the iodine. So in a nuclear accident, you still have that iodine, those iodine clouds that come over, for example, in Chernobyl, where iodine clouds, and these are now not normal iodine, but radioactive iodine, and it falls on the grass, it gets incorporated into the milk, and then when people eat this, it gets incorporated into their thyroid gland. So their thyroid gland becomes much more radioactive, and that could cause damage over the long haul.
Generally causes cancer is what it causes.
It could do that. People use radioactive iodine to basically burn out their thyroid gland if they have Graves' disease or they have, their thyroid has got cancer. It's overproducing thyroid hormones. So it's not uncommon that people can expose themselves to that. So
yeah, but in my experience, it's also not.
No, you don't want to expose yourself.
Yeah, no. I mean, people get cancer, other forms of cancer from the exposure.
And it's much more problematic in young people who, whose glands are developing and dividing. And that's true for, radioactive exposure in anybody whose bodies are still developing. You don't want that to happen. So usually the cautions are for young people to try to avoid to have that radioactive iodine that might be in the environment be taken up by the thyroid. And the way they do it is they give you a whole lot of what's called potassium iodide.
Well, let me ask you something there. First of all, we're talking about radioactive iodine, and then there's sort of iodine that we get from seafood and fish and some protein foods like eggs. So obviously, the organic form of iodine, I guess I could say, is it right to say it's the organic form and the stuff that we're getting from nuclear fission products is inorganic?
You could say it's all organic. I mean, it's hot, literally.
Well, it's having a different effect.
It does because it's releasing radioactivity that can be damaging to cells.
Okay.
So it's what it's doing. It's releasing a radioactive isotope that is potentially can go through a cell and cause damage to DNA.
Now, let me also make another point here, which is that exposure to nuclear fission products doesn't just damage the thyroid. It causes damage to all the tissues of the body. And
it can. I mean, they've looked at, for example, uranium miners, and if you get uranium, you're working in a mine, you're digging uranium, and you get uranium in your lungs, it can increase the incidence of lung cancer. So there's another.
Oh, and plutonium is really vicious.
Exposure
stuff.
To those kinds of things that depends on where it ends up in your body and whether or not it's going to stay in your body for a very long period of time. The iodine in the thyroid, because it's incorporated into that protein, so that radioactive iodine molecule can get stuck on that protein and can stay in your thyroid for quite a long period of time. So it has the potential to radiate and do damage there as it's sitting there for a while before it's actually released in the form of thyroid hormone, which is then going to end up in more than likely in your urine, and you'll excrete it.
And then expose other people as well. But then we have different forms of iodine. We have iodine in the form of kelp. We have it from sea vegetables. We have it from fish. We have a form that you get in mineral tablets. And then we have potassium iodide.
Right.
So what is the potassium iodide? Explain what form that is, why it's different.
Well, it's just a salt of iodine.
Yeah.
It's, mm-hmm. You know, normally, when you put that in water, it forms iodide. It's a negative ion, and it's what's taken up by the thyroid. The potassium goes away. It just dissolves. That all dissolves. So it's just the way the potassium, or it could be sodium iodide. These are. It makes the negative charge happy because it's received a positive charge.
Mm-hmm.
So it balances the iodine and it forms a salt. So, in the ocean, you're mostly dealing with iodide and iodine.
Mm-hmm. It's also in our eyes. Potassium iodide is sort of intrinsic to the eyes. If you scratch your eyes or irritate it and you put a drop of potassium iodide or SSKI in some saline solution or some artificial tears, and you rinse your eyes with it, it soothes them immediately because it's in there. It's kind of a natural substance.
Well, the lacrimal glands of the eye, what produce the tears,
right?
They actually have receptors. They have these transporters that soak up iodine, and then so small amounts of iodine can be deposited in the tears and the eyes. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense that all the tissues of the body that are exposed to the external environment have the capacity to take up iodine. The salivary glands, the eyes, the tear ducts of the eyes, and also the glands that put fluid, liquid over your eyes to keep them wet. Your gastrointestinal tract, every part of your body that's exposed to the external environment has the capacity to take up and concentrate iodine and actually convert it in some cases to a form that's antimicrobial. It makes perfect sense that the iodine is helping us keep us from getting cavities in our mouth because the salivary glands are taking this up. The breast tissue takes it up, the eyes, so all tissues, the nasal cavity, the gastrointestinal tract, these are all capable of concentrating, taking up iodine and converting it into forms that the bugs that, make us sick, bacteria, virus, fungi, things of that nature, they don't like. So they tend to be destroyed. That's why in surgery, we use betadine, which is iodine, and we rub it on the body. It's that yellow stuff, before surgery that you get scrubbed on you. That's iodine. So it's antimicrobial. It doesn't. It destroys bacteria. That's why I was just reading. When you have water that is
mm-hmm.
contaminated,
right.
You can use iodine tablets. You throw the iodine tablet in the contaminated water, and it'll kill all the things that could make you sick. Unless it had some chemical in there,
it won't purify chemicals, but it kills.
No. It kills bacteria, viruses, and things.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Dr. David Zava. Z as in zebra, A V as in Victor A. Zava, at CRT Labs, and we're talking about iodine. And right now, we're talking about iodide. Now, one of the things that's really tricky about iodine. no matter how you take it, whether you take it in iodine or iodide, is that there are terrible consequences for having not enough and also having too much. So when a nuclear incident arrives, this dosing of iodide is very delicate, and there's a lot of, you know, people throw around a lot of information about how to do this. But you sent me a wonderful paper that was a study done after Chernobyl. So why don't you go over some of the things that were found and what we understand at this point about how this works and how it should be done?
Well, you know, what happened in Chernobyl is that the radioactivity was released and it basically made its way over to Poland and different areas of Poland. And so radioactivity levels were going up, and it was radioactive iron, and they were concerned that you know, it was going to be taken up. And they actually found it was taken up in the thyroids of young kids and other people. And so to prevent that, they want to give you a really large dose of potassium iodide. So most pharmacies, you know, are prepared and have potassium iodide. So they gave them large amounts of potassium iodide. What that does basically is it's taken up by the thyroid. The thyroid says, I've had enough. Now I'm not going to take up any more iodine. So the radioactive stuff that their bodies are exposed to can't get taken up by the thyroid. So that's basically how that happens. And
let's talk about the kind of dosing that was used, because to give people some kind of reference point, the usual, you know, if we can trust these RDI type of measurements, the usual sort of recommended dose of iodine
is
maybe 150 micrograms, 225 micrograms, right?
Yeah, it's a World Health Organization, CDC, in all the studies that they've done, in order to prevent thyroid deficiency, you need about, you know, 150 to 200 micrograms of iodine.
Or even 225, I think, is okay.
Yeah, it depends on pregnancy and so on. But, yeah, probably minimally 150 micrograms is what mm-hmm. you need. And, you know, that's an RDA. So it's probably on the low side.
Yep.
The amount of, in Japan, you know, they look at the low end, and they also look at the high end in the United States. And they say, okay, 150 is what you 150 to 300 is probably what you should be taking. It's okay if you go up to 1100. So that would be 1.1 milligrams.
Because mm-hmm. you're getting it in your food, right?
1,000. Yeah, they say no consequences of getting up to 1,000. And people, yeah, you can take a vitamin, and you can look at your vitamin. It might have, you know, 200 micrograms of iodine. You can look on the bottle. You eat some fish, you might get that much. Most people not around here are not going to be eating seaweed, but you know, they'll get 200 to 300. Some people take iodine, and their levels will go up. You know, they're taking more than that. The Japanese have determined that it's okay to go up to 3 milligrams or 3,000 micrograms.
That's a lot.
Yeah, 100. So it's 20 times higher than recommended by. But they're saying we don't see any untoward effects much when people take it up to that level. However, higher than that, you know, taking it over a long period of time might cause some problems. And they've actually shown that in subsets of people, it does cause problems. Now, the amount that they're giving, and we're talking about, let's say, a daily exposure to iodine, not so much a bolus of it. With a nuclear incident like, you know, has happened in Chernobyl and also in Japan, what they're recommending is that you take a lot of iodine immediately after the event, because what that does is that prevents the radioactive iodine from getting in. Because once mm-hmm. radioactive iodine gets in, it's going to take a long time to get it out of there.
Okay, so the dosing that I saw in this article was somewhere between 100 and 130, or maybe even you could go to 150.
That's milligrams.
So milligrams, right, milligrams.
Yeah, we're talking about 130,000 mm-hmm. micrograms mm-hmm. as opposed to 130. Right. So that's 1,000 times more.
Right.
And even with that bolus dosing, and they looked at side effects and thyroid, you know, issues and things like that, they didn't see a lot of problems. But again, that's a bolus dose. It's fine. Not a problem for most people to take, you know, a bolus dose of thyroid up to, you know, 50, 150 milligrams of that just one time to
exactly that's
block
the key
your thyroid. But when
wait, you're going too fast.
Yeah.
You said one dose, which is very important. So one dose of a high dose,
right,
and taken at the time that there is exposure.
Right.
At the time of a high exposure.
It's got to be early.
Yeah, either right away after or...
before that radioactive cloud.
Well, or at the exact time that, I mean, at least what I read.
Right.
Is right
and
then.
So everybody in the near vicinity of those nuclear reactors needs to be, and I'm sure they are, being dosed with a relatively high amount of potassium ion.
Yeah, there's no indication. It's hard to say. Anyway, this is what this study showed. But also, just to give people some idea... potassium iodide, which I think of as a very well-tolerated form of iodine,
right,
is available in a liquid form called SSKI, and one drop is 150 milligrams, so that's the one bolus dose. The advantage to taking a liquid dose over a pill, because I ran this by Richard Cunyon, MD, is that the pill form will tend to bioaccumulate more than a liquid dose. A liquid dose will go in and out pretty fast. Now, what we saw in this article about Chernobyl 2 is that even in the case of people who have thyroid disease, and this is a big if because people with thyroid disease are very sensitive to iodine, and when they're dosed with a large dose of iodine, if the dosing continues for any length of time, will have a thyroid toxicosis or a thyroid storm. They become very hyperthyroid.
What they found is that people who are sensitive to iodine, they're really kind of two categories. There are category people who have thyroid, it's called autonomous thyroid nodules. And these might be small nodules that have the capacity to make thyroid hormone if they see a lot of iodine. So they've been pretty much starved for a long period of time. And it's mostly in the elderly, elderly meaning, you know, past 50. And it's,
that isn't elderly. Those are young people.
They would qualify. So what happens is these autonomous nodules all of a sudden start to manufacture a lot of thyroid hormone. So you become go into thyrotoxicosis. It's toxic and cause heart palpitations. Just make you feel bad. It's kind of, as you described, the difference to me one time, and I always tell people about this. I said the difference between hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism is one suicidal, the other is homicidal.
Oh, I told you that.
Yeah, you told me that.
From personal experience.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can become hyperthyroid in some people. In other people who tend to be sort of subclinical, they're hanging that kind of lowish thyroid and their TSH is not elevated enough for a doctor to say, you know, you need some thyroid hormone, which probably means they do need thyroid hormone.
Probably.
What happens is it pushes you into real clinical hypothyroidism. It lowers your T4. It lowers your T3.
Okay.
It raises your TSH. And we've seen people in testing who's go on to an iodine product, and their TSH just shoots up. It goes way, way up, and their thyroid hormones go down. Now, they feel bad because they become hypothyroid. So that's the opposite end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. They become hypothyroid. So you could go either direction. And a lot of people can take, you know, the bigger doses for a long period of time, and it really doesn't have much impact on them. But you need to watch if you're really feeling bad when you take an iodine source that you may be told that you're detoxing.
No.
But it's probably an effect of the iodine on your thyroid more than it is a detox effect.
Yeah, I find that there are a certain style of alternative medicine doctors who believe that if you hit your face with a hammer a lot and it hurts, they tell you you're detoxing.
Right.
So I think you have to be careful. I think the important thing to point out here, if I can just unpack some of this, is that iodine in the early days when people were diagnosed with autoimmune thyroid diseases like Graves and Hashimoto's, where there's actually an antibody problem, and particularly in Graves where you end up with a hyperthyroidism that isn't transient, it's permanent, the early form of thyroid, you know, paralyzing the thyroid or even stopping it from producing hormone at all, sort of permanently, was to give people high doses of iodine or iodine.
That's what happens. That, you know, that shuts it down.
Right.
That,
so so one
don't make any more.
So even if you have a healthy thyroid, and I've seen this in my practice, somebody comes in and they're just chowing down, you know, lots and lots and lots of iodine from taking kelp and also eating lots of, and again, you see this elevated TSH. There's also a big debate going on about whether or not, because there are some doctors who have a sort of program that they've been doing for 10 years studying the effects of giving people just astronomical doses of iodine in these special Lugol's sort of thing. And they report that people are being cured of all sorts of diseases, but in the meantime, some of them have these really high TSHs. And Dr. Alan Gaby did a good editorial. I think it was a good editorial about the fact that there's not good evidence that this is safe to do or even advisable to do. Again, when we're talking about responding to a specific nuclear event, the dosing is one loading dose.
Right.
And then it could be conceivably repeated a few other times if this incident sort of continues to be a problem, like a, you know,
but not every day,
but not every day for long periods of time. And certainly, as you just said, if you feel funny, if you don't feel right, either you feel really jittery or you suddenly start feeling really tired, cut it out, and be particularly cautious about people, you know, with anyone who has any questions about their thyroid function, maybe one loading dose is sufficient. And then if you hear that there's more danger coming your way, you could do it again, but certainly not as a continuous thing, at least according to my experience, you know, observing thyroid patients and reading the literature. And I think you agree.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay, so what we saw in Chernobyl is that it was well tolerated. One dose, like 100 to 150 milligrams, not micrograms, of potassium iodide was well tolerated even by people with thyroid disease. The only people who did horribly with it were people who were literally allergic to iodine, which there are people who are, and people who have respiratory symptoms when they take it. So obviously don't
do that. And you should know that. And they didn't recommend that the adults take it. So they were...
Well, they did give it to some, though, didn't they?
They did give it to some, but they probably, for the most part, were those who were more sensitive to that. They were not recommending that they take it. So, you know, it's like, okay, well, that means the baby boomers, you know, everybody that's doing this kind of stuff. So it's, I certainly see a lot of people who suffer from taking iodine and they think that they're detoxing and they're actually probably suffering from excessive iodine. And unfortunately, they're being told, oh, you're detoxing, you need to take more iodine, and that's making them worse.
Now, the good news about Chernobyl was that when people were dosed, both in the children and in the adults, the incidence of future problems with their thyroid, including, you know, nodules and things, but even cancer, was reduced. I mean, there was protection. It's also important to note that taking potassium iodide protects your thyroid from thyroid damage from radioactive iodine, but it doesn't protect all your tissues from the DNA damage of exposure to ionizing radiation, of which I will say emphatically there is no safe dose. You may decide to expose yourself to it because you have some medical procedure that you feel is worth the risk and you're old enough so that you're not expecting to get a secondary cancer from it, but know that the dosage that you get from medical procedures is far above what would be considered safe, and there is no safe dose, according to John Goffman, who did all the wonderful research for years on the incidence of breast and other cancers and heart damage, also from radiation, from medical procedures. So don't live near a power plant, you know, and don't, I mean, and the thing that we'll discuss after the break, I'm going to take a short break here, is the fact that if you take a regular maintenance dose of iodine, at least your thyroid and probably some of your reproductive system and other parts of your endocrine system will be probably protected. At least it looks that way. So, David, if you will, hang on. We just need to take a brief musical break. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I have on the phone today David T. Zava, Z as in zebra, A, V as in Victor A, Zava, PhD from ZRT Labs. And we'll be back after this break, and we'll continue to talk about iodine. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with David T. Zava, Z-A-V-A, Zava with a Z, Ph.D., from ZRT Labs. A reminder that there's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, full hour version, our archive, CD copies, our book. All of it's at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. Information, email us at admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. And David, again, the current website for the lab?
ZRTlab.com.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. I thought you had a fancier one at this point.
No, it's that simple. I believe in simplicity.
Oh, I agree with you. Okay, now, we've talked about the fact that some people... What's happening is that you've developed an interesting test that's really easy for people to do at home. And what you're noticing is that people are iodine deficient. They're sort of subclinical. I mean, it's a very low level of deficiency. But let's talk about what sorts of people are most vulnerable and who are most likely to be iodine deficient.
Well, the people that are... first thing you need to realize about iodine is that when you consume it, it's pretty much gone. You know, what you consume is gone in 24 hours, so it goes through your body real fast. So you need to be able to get adequate levels. It's sort of like food. You got to eat it every day. You need to get adequate levels every day in either the food you eat or the nutrition supplements you take or whatever. And iodine is contained where we live. The United States inland, iodine is contained mostly in milk and eggs and some green leafy vegetables, not too much, but mostly milk and eggs. Along the seashore, we have sea fish and so on. It's contained, you know, you get it out of fish that live in the sea because the iodine source is the sea. That's where it comes from. And as I said earlier, it evaporates. In the form of iodine, it's I2, and it moves with the clouds, and then it rains onto the grasses, and then the chickens and the cattle, they eat it and concentrate it in the eggs and the milk. So that's where we get most of our source of iodine. We can get it from iodized salt if we eat iodized salt.
Yeah, which is potassium chloride.
We've moved away from that a little bit.
I mean,
people are salt sensitive and they're trying to keep their blood pressure down.
Well, it's also not... sodium chloride is a very irritating form of salt. Sea salt is a much better... I just don't understand...
The sea salt doesn't have...
Why is that,
near
though?
...near as much the amount of iodine.
So it does have
iodized
some.
Iodized salt.
Very it has little. Some.
It's not going to make much difference
okay.
in your iodine level. So, but... So you can get it from iodized salt, but those are the primary sources. In areas of the world where it's very arid and doesn't rain very much, those are the areas, and also on the top of mountains where it washes out very rapidly, those are the areas that are going to be the most deficient in iodine. So people here that don't eat fish, or vegetarians, don't eat any kind of eggs or drink, milk products, are going to be the most likely to be iodine deficient. And that's what we see.
Well, it's also, it's very simple to just take a multivitamin, which I recommend anyway, at the very least, you take a multivitamin.
Yeah, but people don't do that. Some people,
they don't.
You know, they'll have a bad diet. They'll have only a vegetarian diet and they don't get any source of iodine.
Although I will say, depending on what kind of processed, I hate people eating processed foods. But people who even eat bread, that's baked in a bakery are, I mean, some of the more whole foodie type places are using sea salt, but right. any conventional food has commercial salt in it, which again I find is irritating for people. It may
be
the reason.
Well, they don't usually use iodine in commercial.
No, but they use regular commercial salt, which is iodized salt.
Not necessarily. It depends on the bakery, but so you get your iodine from eggs and milk and
vitamins.
Iodized salt and from
multivitamins.
You can look in the bottle. The bottle will tell you if it's got.
Well, any multivitamin has it.
They probably don't have enough. They'll tell you if they've got the RDA for vitamin for iodine, which would be 150 micrograms. Not all of them do. You can look and see. Some do, some don't.
Okay.
So that's your source of iodine. If you don't get enough from those sources, I guarantee you your iodine levels are going to be low. And the problem with low iodine levels is that not only you're going to have more problems with your thyroid, but other issues such as the iodine is, like I said, is protective. It helps your immune system. Iodine helps in preventing abnormal cell growth, particularly in the reproductive tissues, such as the breast and the uterus. So that can cause some problems. We just did a urine iodine test on a woman just last week who, my conversations with the physician, I was really surprised. I said, she's got really low iodine level, and it so happens that she had just been diagnosed with breast cancer. So there's a definite correlation of iodine levels to cancer, in particular breast cancer. Now the breast takes up, that's why you've got iodine in milk. Now the breast isn't normally lactating, but the breast tissue itself, during lactation, when the mother is producing milk for the baby, has one of those concentrating mechanisms to take up iodine and incorporate it into the milk protein. And so that exact same thing happens in cows or any other animal that's producing milk, is the iodine is taken up and it's incorporated into the milk so that the infant gets adequate levels of iodine. And so when we drink milk or we eat cheese or anything, made from milk, we're getting an iodine source. People who don't consume those kind of things are not going to be getting as much iodine. Not necessarily, necessarily have to get it from that source, but that is a big source. And also, they treat the udders of the cows to prevent infections and stuff with, they wipe them down with iodine, just like, the betadine they use in surgery to keep bugs from growing, to keep bacteria and stuff from growing. And that absorbs into the milk, so it can increase the iodine content of milk also. Because of that, so you get iodine, you get a lot of iodine from milk products, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you're gonna get a lot of iodine, like if you don't drink enough, of those kinds of things. So I always we were doing some tests here in the laboratory, and we were looking at different levels in urine at different times of the day, and we kept seeing these higher levels occurring at about 11 or 12 o'clock, and we realized that, these people were, in the morning, they were having their lattes.
Oh, interesting.
Lots of milk, and that's where they're getting their iodine source from.
Yeah.
That would have been a good, that was a good thing. It went way up, and then it came back down by night. So it clears out of your body really fast.
That's good news.
But it's very important for normal development of the reproductive tissues. Very important for normal development of the breast. Very important for normal development of the uterus, too.
I want to go back for a second to thyroid disease because there's a real catch-22 here, and I think that you're in the beginning stages of doing this testing, so you may not have a conclusive answer to this yet. But when you've got someone who already has a damaged thyroid, and I'm not talking about, early on, like childhood development is, it's essential for the mother to have sufficient iodine.
Right.
Otherwise, you end up with a baby who's damaged, whose brain is damaged, and thyroid is damaged and all that, and maybe even has a lot of neurological and brain symptoms, injuries sort of, from lack of iodine and lack of a sufficient thyroid hormone. But once you've got someone whose thyroid is damaged either by some form of pollution that they've been exposed to, or radioactivity, nuclear, ionizing radiation, so many different ways to damage the thyroid, mercury, so many different ways. So you've got a damaged thyroid. So you've got someone who is very sensitive to iodine, and they're suppressing their thyroid function. Now, in the case of Graves, ironically, it turns out that iodine actually is one of the a lack of iodine is one of the triggers for developing Graves. If you have insufficient iodine, you're more likely to get Graves, along with cigarette smoking and stress. But once you've got this damaged thyroid and you're trying to suppress thyroid function, people are very sensitive to iodine and usually avoid iodine. So do we know when people are replacing their thyroid hormone and taking these converted, especially if they're taking a desiccated a pork thyroid where you're actually getting hormones from the gland that have already done this conversion, do you know yet from your testing whether people with thyroid disease are getting coverage without eating? I mean, obviously some people are still eating eggs and getting it from other food sources, but if they're not taking it as a supplement, do you know?
Well, there some do, some don't. It, you know, I guess it depends on their eating habits, you know, the kind of foods they eat and whether or not they have a latte in the morning or where they get that latte from and where that milk comes from, because if it comes from the ocean, it's, you know, close by here where I live in, you know, Portland and in Tillamook, which is, you know, lots of cheeses and milk produced right there, you know, up against the ocean. You're going to have a lot of iodine.
Yeah, but if you've got someone who isn't eating milk and maybe eats, you know, maybe gets other food sources, but and has to avoid high doses.
There's only one way to know.
Well, what I'm saying is that it appears. I know, but what I'm saying is, along with testing, is that you've got an interesting catch-22 situation, because if you start loading up on iodine and you don't feel well, you may indeed have a thyroid disease.
So you
have to sort of check that out.
I can tell you what people look at, what the CDC and other people have looked at in terms of, you know, how you're doing with your iodine. They look not only at iodine. Now they can look at iodine in urine. That's pretty traditionally how it's, you know, how people look at it, determine whether or not you're deficient. So you can do that, and that'll tell you, okay, for that day that you test, well, that's fine, because that day, all right, you're low or you're high or you're, if you just eat your average diet and you test, you'll pretty much know whether you're high or low. And then there are other things you can look at that tell you something about the thyroid. The other thing, you can do a blood test and you can look at what's called thyroglobulin. Now, thyroglobulin is a protein that's produced uniquely by the thyroid gland, just like PSA is produced uniquely by the prostate gland. So thyroglobulin.
PSA is also produced in women, and they don't have prostates.
Yeah, but very extremely small amounts. So,
well, no, actually, one of the problems. I'm sorry, I'm going on a sidekick here, but it's true that. Well, let me just say this so that it gets out there. The problem with the PSA test is that they've tested women, and they come up with high levels too. So the test is not very accurate, but that's fine. That's a different subject.
And I've looked lots.
Oh, you've never seen that?
Never seen it.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, you're
like,
doing the testing. I'm not.
No, I've never seen it.
Okay.
So the thyroglobulin is produced uniquely in the thyroid gland. And when it's – and that's the protein that I was talking about earlier that the iodine sticks to. So it gets all these iodine molecules around. It's like a big glob of protein, and it's all these iodines are being stuffed on it. And then, as I said earlier, that then is broken down and converted into thyroid hormones. Well, that thyroglobulin molecule, if it doesn't get enough iodine put on it, it tends to leak out of the thyroid gland into the bloodstream. So we can measure it. So we see elevated levels of thyroglobulin. That means that's a marker of a lack of iodine. So that means that person, over a longer period of time, has not been exposed to enough iodine. So it's not just a day. This is more... Okay, what's been your iodine status over the last couple of weeks? Because if your thyroglobulin is high, that means that you really weren't getting enough iodine. So that's the interpretation of that. The other thing is that we look at things like total T4. And total T4 is the total amount of thyroxine, or the thyroid hormone that's that's being released from the thyroid gland. And that's coming from that thyroglobulin. So we look at that and go, okay, that's normal or that's low. So it can be, it could be on the lower side. So you're looking at that. You also look at TSH, because if T4 is low and TSH is high, then you really do have a situation where your body, your brain is saying, I'm not seeing enough thyroid hormone. And so I'm releasing this TSH from the brain to make the thyroid produce more thyroid hormone, more T4. And if you don't have enough iodine, it's not going to happen, because that's really the starting point of making thyroid hormones. Now, I'm sure I probably confused everybody, but...
Well, but you said something to me on the phone when we talked about the show. You said people shouldn't load up on iodine if they have thyroid disease, so people should be checking to see that they have... Because you can have normal thyroid levels and still have antibodies attacking your thyroid. Yep. So
if,
that's worth checking.
If when you take... if you have a sort of subclinical problem with your thyroid, and you take a big dose of iodine and your TSH shoots up, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
Because what it means is that your body is not, with that high dose of iodine, is thyroid hormone synthesis is being shut off.
Well, but we also said that that was the way of suppressing thyroid function in people who, yeah. So it's,
exactly.
It does
some,
if you overdose.
Some people are more sensitive to
sure.
that. Normally what happens is that process goes into place, and then the thyroid backs off and it corrects itself.
Okay.
But in some people it doesn't do that, and that TSH stays high. And when TSH stays high, TSH stimulates the growth of the thyroid. So people can get goiters. It can cause overgrowth of the thyroid. It's not a thyroid cancer, but it's an overgrowth, and they begin to get goiters from that if that happens.
Which is never good. Let me just say, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with David Zava, with a Z, like zebra, Z-A-V-A. He is at ZRT Lab, ZRT.com. He is a biochemist, and we're talking about iodine. Okay, the part that I just don't want to be confusing to people is too little iodine, bad. Too much iodine, maybe also bad. So
kind of like water.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
A little, too much.
Yeah.
It's like anything you put in your body. It, you know, all biological systems work that way. And iodine is no different.
So there are different types of testing done. And there's been, for a long time, this sort of loading dose test versus spot urine, you know, test, which is what you're doing, and versus the 24-hour urine test. And, I mean, obviously you chose the test that you thought worked best after reviewing all the tests, so why don't you review the tests for us? Tell us what you think.
Yeah, there are different ways of testing for iodine. Probably the most popular right now out there is what's called a loading dose. And that's the one that just Google Alan Gaby and iodine, and you'll find everything you ever want to know about what he's
doing.
G-A-B-Y, Alan Gaby and iodine controversy, something like that. Google, if you Google, you'll find everything you ever wanted to know about it. So, but basically, and I agree with what Dr. Gaby says about the loading dose, and that is what they say with the loading dose is if you take 50 milligrams of iodine at one time, and then you collect your urine over a 24-hour period. And then you measure the amount, and let's say you take 50, and then you collect all your urine, and you do a test on it, and you have only 40 that comes out that you can add up all your urine that you've collected. Then you've got 80%. What they say is if you don't have 90 plus percent, then you have a whole body insufficiency. That means all the tissues of your body, including your thyroid, are not saturated enough with iodine, and that you have a deficiency, and that you should take more. So the problem with that is that everybody fails that test.
Everybody. No! Oh, dear.
And so that means that, oh, good, we can give you some iodine. It just so happens that the same people that fail you on that test have got the product for you. So I have a little bit of an issue with that, you know, that they're not only testing you, but they're recommending the product that they sell.
Mm.
So that's a little bit of an issue for me, that, you know, labs that have a test and then sell you a product. So it's an advantage for you to fail, because I'll sell you more product. So that's my first big controversy with that. But we have done tests on that, and what we've found is that when you take a loading dose of iodine, say 50 milligrams, and then you collect over a period of a day, or, you know, you continue to collect, what we found is that we get to about 70% in the first 24 hours. So we collect our urine the way they recommend over the first 24 hours, and we go, oh, well, we didn't make it. We only excreted 35 out of 50 milligrams. But we kept collecting. And what we saw is that over the next 24 hours, so up to 48 hours, we got all the rest of it out. So, you know, they're assuming that in 24 hours you're going to release all the iodine that you took, the 50 milligrams, and that's not true. And the other issue is, you know, when people have a bowel movement, they release some urine at the same time, and they don't collect that. They're not even thinking about it. And so you lose some of that iodine at that point, and so you might lose up to 10%, particularly if it's within 4 or 5 hours of just taking the iodine tablet.
Well, you can mention the name of the brand that they're using.
Iderol. Yeah, it's Iderol. So there are lots of reasons why you would fail that test, and no one's really ever proven that, you know, that proves that you have a whole body insufficiency. Now, where Alan, Gaby, and I both agree is that iodine is a very important nutrient and that we need more of it. The other thing that hypothesis on the loading dose is that they're saying that you need to get iodine levels to the level of what the Japanese take. And they're saying that you need, you know, 12 to 15 milligrams of iodine daily in order to achieve that. And that's actually not true. That's not how much.
It's pretty high, yeah.
That's not how much the Japanese. We've looked at hundreds of journal articles on that subject. And the Japanese, at the top end, they're getting, you know, somewhere between 1 and probably 3 or 4 milligrams in eating seaweed and stuff like that. And,
so
and
it's like 1,000 micrograms, yeah.
Yeah, it's what they had recommended. You know, it would go more than about 3,000 or 3 milligrams. So that's about what they get in a normal, if they're eating a lot of seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
They probably realistically get, you know, 500 micrograms. The average Japanese, you know, living close to the coast is getting 500 micrograms as opposed to the, you know, 150 that's recommended by the
RDI.
Yeah, the RDI. So they're not getting that much. They're saying, the people, you know, that promote the loading dose are saying that you need to get the amount that the Japanese are eating, and they're saying it's 12 milligrams. It's not. It's about one-tenth of that. It's about 1.25. That's the published literature. So, and they don't, the problem is they only reference themselves. So they only, you know,
it is a problem, isn't it?
They self-publish. None of their work is peer-reviewed, not a bit of it.
Mm.
No one outside their own organization has actually looked at it and, you know, critiqued it. No other scientists have critiqued it. So it's kind of in a world of its own, as opposed to the huge amount of literature that's out there on iodine testing that's been done by, you know, other groups all over the world, where they're looking at urine level. Now, that's not to say that their tests are not good. I think their tests are good, but it's the interpretation that's off. And that's what Alan Gaby and I both agree on, is that they're saying you need a lot of iodine. That doesn't mean that you don't need more, which both of us agree that most people here in the United States are getting insufficient amounts of iodine, but not at, you know, at that higher level, because it can create problems in some people. In others, not, but in some people, it can start to mess with the thyroid and cause the thyroid.
How can you anticipate that?
It's not anticipated.
You just have to kind of catch it as it
happens.
Well,
it's the literature. I mean,
but I'm saying, you know, if somebody...
Well, you can look at your, you know, thyroid levels. If your TSH shoots up...
Yeah, you just watch it is the
it's
point.
TSH is going to be hammering away at your thyroid and making it grow.
Yeah.
And you don't want that to happen.
No, it's very bad to get a goiter because they often have to remove your thyroid in order to get rid of the goiter.
Well, it could, you know, it results in all sorts of clinical issues for you. It might be benign, and generally they tend to go away when you stop taking it. But I just, you know, we've been doing this kind of testing now. Boy, we're getting a lot of people that are communicating with us and telling us how terrible they feel by taking iodine. And you tend to hear more from those who are feeling worse about it. There are plenty of people that do just fine. But there are plenty of people that are not doing well, and they tend to, you know, have issues with their thyroid. And they had issues with their thyroid before they start taking anything. The people that are probably going to suffer the most from it are those people who are going to take only the iodine and are not compensating by taking thyroid at the same time.
Okay, that's what I wondered. So there's a complementary effect. If you are taking thyroid, you have some protection over getting a goiter.
It's equivalent to, I mean, if you take iodine, it suppresses your thyroid's ability to make thyroid hormone.
Right.
So now you're hypothyroid.
Mm-hmm.
If you
overdose, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, because you've overdosed that.
That's
now,
right.
Now you're going to suffer all the consequences of low thyroid. If you and that's the equivalent of having your thyroid taken out. So what do you do for somebody who's had their thyroid taken out? You give them thyroid.
That's right.
So those people who, you know, who take the iodine and they also take thyroid hormone are much less likely to suffer.
And again, this is someone whose thyroid is already damaged.
They've already started on thyroid for whatever reason.
Yes.
Now those people are probably going to benefit the most because now the iodine has an opportunity to be beneficial to other parts of the body.
All right. So the most important point here is for people to pay very close attention to what they're taking and maybe not overdo it. I mean, what we're saying is,
you know, get your thyroid checked.
Well, for sure. But also, it sounds like people can get iodine from food sources. And if they supplement, certainly take a multivitamin, if nothing else, but also supplement prudently and probably not go above 1,000 micrograms a day. So
yeah,
that sounds like it's...
Some are probably between, you know, 1,000 and 3,000.
Okay.
It's probably what the...
Yeah,
I, mean,
yeah, I don't know if I want to recommend 3,000 on the air. Because it's going to be very individual.
It's not a recommendation. It's just, you know,
but people
Japanese,
take it that way. So let's just be, I'm just saying, you know.
The Japanese say it's okay to go up to 3,000. In the United States, they say it's okay to go up to 1,000. So, you know, take your pick. That's not a recommendation. This is what the agency study this stuff.
I got to let you go.
Yeah.
I'm completely out of time.
All right.
Thank you so much, David T. Zava, Z as in zebra, A-V-A. PhD. We're talking about iodine. His lab is ZRT, Z as in zebra, R as in Ralph, T as in Tom, .com, ZRTLabs.com.
It's singular.
ZRTLab.com.
Right.
Thank you for that. And thank you so much for all this information.
You're
just such a good guest. Thank you again.
All right. Take care, Lana.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lana Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guest, our practice, a free hour stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, and there's lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org with everything spelled out. Our information number, well, actually our information is email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lana Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.